everyone. We have an interesting show for you today. We hope you stay tuned to the Conspiracy Hour. First of all, I thought we would start out by addressing the situation about whether or not Uncle Sam, the United States government, is involved in conspiracies, whether or not they play fair. I think the best example of this right now is the story about Julian Assange. Remember him from WikiLeaks? He's over in the embassy there, the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK, and he's not able to get out because the United States and Sweden want to extradite him. Assange says it's just an excuse, a trumped-up charge, this rape charge that they have him on, just to get him over to Sweden so they can extradite him. At the extradition, it will be easier from there. One of the interesting things about that case is overnight, it has come to my attention that the condom used evidence on Assange about the sex case doesn't have the right DNA. In other words, the condom used as evidence in the sex case does not contain his DNA. Swedish authorities requesting his extradition from Britain to lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange have revealed a very key piece of evidence. It does not contain his DNA. The torn condom given to the Swedish police by one of the alleged victims was examined by staff at two forensic laboratories, but they could not find any conclusive evidence of Assange's DNA on it at all. The same forensic teams found DNA thought to be from the WikiLeaks boss on another condom, which was submitted by the second alleged victim. The revelation is that it contained, in actually a 100-page report to the police, that there was no DNA from Assange. So they are now re-examining everything, talking to the witnesses again, and reviewing the forensic evidence. But will they drop the extradition efforts? We doubt it. Stay tuned. We have a very good example of the U.S. government working with law enforcement on how to frame people they want to get out of the way. That's coming up in this segment. But first, I need to respond to an email from Dr. James H. Pitzer, Scholars for 9/11 Truth. On our 9/11 program last week, we talked about how the airplanes might have been remote controlled. We had Jim Mars on, and we discussed several examples of how this had happened in the past. Well, Pitzer says that he has come to the conclusion now that there were no airplanes at all involved in the World Trade Center crash. He writes, "I'm glad to know you are open-minded." Fetzer goes on and says, "Jerry, it was not done using remote-controlled airplanes. I have published at least a half dozen articles about this in which I lay out the evidence that it was not airplanes." Now, Fetzer and I have talked about this for some time, and I want to assure him and his crew and our listeners as well that we intend to cover this aspect of it very much in great detail. Fetzer says he has some interesting background information on the hijackers. He also says the phone calls were faked and they're missing airplane parts. I want to assure everyone that we'll be getting into these theories, these possible hypotheses, as we examine all of the possibilities. And then our plan is to narrow it down to get the real story of what happened. In fact, later in this program, we have Fetzer coming up, and he'll be talking to us about some of the interesting things about the 9/11 crash, some of the anomalies, some of the things we just addressed. Frankly, Professor Fetzer, and he is a man from academia, thinks that the fabrication of all four crash sites is a reality, a fact. As wild as this idea sounded originally, I want to assure everyone listening that we are going to examine this possibility. You know, I thought that it would be probably time to present some evidence about the United States government and the U.S. military and black operations and the CIA, how they all work with law enforcement by not necessarily collusion, just subterfuge, and getting people out of the way who have information and want to go public, and of course they don't want you to go public. So we are presenting John McCarthy here in a minute, and a little bit of his story. It's incredible. The long and short of it is McCarthy ended up going to jail on a false charge of murder while he was doing his duty in Vietnam as a special forces officer. And he was working in a black operations assignment in Thailand. And he came back and wanted to talk about it. Lo and behold, they charged him with murder, got a conviction in a military court, and he ended up in Leavenworth, Kansas. And then only by an incident of luck did someone find the paperwork and see that he was framed. Unfortunately, this story is repeated more often than not.
John McCarthy had a prize duty assignment with Special Forces in Southeast Asia during the 1960s.
But before the end of the decade, McCarthy would end up in Leavenworth, charged with murder. As you listen to this program week after week in a series, you will understand one fact.
That conspiracy is the standard operating procedure of the United States government.
John McCarthy, it's a pleasure having you on the air with me.
Thank you, sir.
I think we need to let the audience know that you were a military man. You were a military brat. You grew up. And your dad was in the Army, an officer, and you have some early memories, I know, about your dad and about his overseas assignments.
I asked my dad when we were downtown Kobe, which was had been an industrial city, an aircraft manufacturing city, and the place was in rubble in late 46 as a result of firebombing during World War II. And I asked my dad what happened, and he said there was a war here. And I said, well, why? And he said, because the wrong guy was in charge. He said, but the Japanese people are very industrious, learn their language, they're great engineers, and pay attention to what they say. They're very kind people. So I did that. And then when we got to Munich, Germany in 1953, I had a similar question, because one square block of the city of Munich had been preserved in rubble. And I asked my dad what happened here, and he said, well, we had a war. And I said, well, why? And he said, because the wrong guy was in charge. Well, that
seems to be the thing that goes on through history.
It does. And when I got to Vietnam, I found out the wrong guy was in charge, too.
Yeah.
But, as
I said, John, your dad was an officer, and so were you. You were a captain in the Special Forces, had some choice, and very important assignments. And you were patriotic, and you never ever dreamed you'd end up at a place where your dad served at one time.
In Fort Leavenworth.
And, well, you went to Fort Leavenworth later.
I did go.
But not the best way.
I went to what they refer to as the long course. They have a short course and a long course at Leavenworth. And that's at the Commanding General Staff College.
In other words, you were a prisoner.
Yes, and people who are polite refer to me as going to the long course. Yeah, and it's called the United States Disciplinary Barracks. We're jumping a bit ahead, but it's not a barracks at all. It was a penitentiary, which because of its conditions and the way people were treated, has been torn down a few years ago.
You were sentenced there to hard labor. I don't know. Does that really mean what it says?
Not making little ones out of big ones anymore as it used to. It's more isolation, confinement, and they do have work programs within the system to make license plates and decals for cars at different military installations, and they have a farm unit which raised cattle and chickens. We had like about 3,000 chickens out there.
Now that's military prison. Is it all Army?
Well, at the time it was Army and Air Force, and I understand now since I graduated from that organization.
Yeah, congratulations.
In 1969. They have since changed, and I think the Navy and the Marines and the Coast Guard are doing their R&R there at this time.
In this series, we'll be presenting John McCarthy and his testimony about what happened to him when he was serving Uncle Sam as an officer, a captain, in the United States Army Special Forces. The story is not pretty. In fact, it's downright ugly. We'll get to that. To make the long story short, he ended up being charged with murder, finally was exonerated, and John is now making it a career of talking about conspiracies and pointing out that the United States government is usually involved. We always open up the phone lines at the Conspiracy Hour at the offices of Jerry Pippin Productions, and people are invited to call in and leave messages for us on leads. We are always looking for witnesses to conspiracies, first-hand testimony. If you have information that you think would be valuable and important for the listeners to know, feel free to call me at 918-682-2630. Now, that's on our website at jerrypippin.com. If you didn't get the number, just go down to the bottom of the page, and it says Contact Us, and we have our phone number there. Or you can email us at jerry@jerrypippin.com. Brian called us up. He wrote a book, I guess, from what he says on the answering machine. He talked about the JFK assassination. You know, the Kennedy assassination's coming up on 50 years. Can you believe that? 50 years and it's still unsettled. It seems to be the modus operandi of the U.S. government. Just keep it confusing, keep it foggy, and don't give the real answers. Anyway, I think you'll find out what Brian is saying here is interesting. It's a theory I hadn't heard of. What do you think?
All right. I am self-taught at most of the things that I do. I did attend 3 years of school, college at the University of Missouri. It started off, though, in 1963, November 22nd. I was in the fifth grade, and I was living in the suburb of Irving. And when all that went down, I had a lot of friends and friends of the family that was very much involved. That eventually then led to a book that I wrote. The name of the book for the JFK is called My God, I'm Hit. And those were the last words, according to the Secret Service agent Roy Kellerman, those were the last words that JFK spoke. It was called My God, I'm Hit. And so growing up in the Dallas area, I then started doing photography at the age of 16. I was also a very big basketball player. I still am. I'm 57 years old, and I still play full-court basketball with 20. The premise of the book, though, is that the Warren Commission said that the bullet went from the back out the throat of JFK. However, Roy Kellerman, the Secret Service agent in the passenger seat, said that after he heard the first shot, he turned and he saw and he heard JFK shout, "My God, I'm hit." And then he also saw JFK with his left hand go to his right shoulder. He didn't see that him grabbing for his throat. That's what he told the FBI. We interviewed the doctor. His name is Dr. McClellan. He was at the throat of the victim at Parkland, and he held the forceps open on the wound on the throat. We asked him, we said, "That wound that you saw in the throat, could a person whisper, nevertheless shout any type of words because of that throat wound?" And he said, "Impossible." So now we have a mystery. Here the Warren Commission says the first shot hits the throat, but then Kellerman says he hears, "My God, I'm hit." How does a person with a bullet wound shout, "My God, I'm hit"? This is a big mystery. What the book does, our book does, is solve this mystery. And as you solve this mystery, the whole JFK incident goes upside down and goes in a whole different direction than what you ever imagined.
A couple of things here. First of all, we listen to all our messages. We answer the phone personally when we can. And you're welcome to call the Jerry Pippin Show offices and talk to us or someone there about any conspiracy information you know. Once again, I'll give the number, 918 682-2630. And to the subject at hand, the JFK assassination. We're getting close to the 50th anniversary. We have lots of information coming up. James H. Fetzer, who we talked about earlier, Scholars for 9/11 Truth, he has made a career of investigating JFK, and he has promised me some new evidence this year for the 50th anniversary, so that'll be coming up too. And another thing we'll be covering later this year is the case of Osama bin Laden. Was that really him, the man we killed? General Gwyle of the Pakistani Army Intelligence Service does not think
Yes,
so.
I think he died. He perished some years ago, and I think this was a story which was created, and I think this was because they themselves are saying, I mean, their versions, nobody would want to believe these versions. Initially, they said that he fought back, and there was a firefight. President Obama himself said that in his initial statement. And now they say that he had no weapons, he didn't do any of those things. Then ISI says that he was living there for the last 5 years. So, and they said that we have informed the CIA and the American partners in 2009 about it. So there are so many versions floating around. As far as I think he had, even if he's not killed, or if he didn't die a natural death, I think it was totally irrelevant to the operations of Al-Qaeda, and I think it was quite futile to have gone and killed him. But I still doubt the story which was given out by the American media and by the American administration.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Hour. I'm Jerry Pippin.
Own the book that has unraveled and shaken the UFO and alien research establishment to its core. Already called An Incredible Book and An Incredible Story by George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, UFO Highway offers the most explosive look at the most infamous underground base in the world, Dulce. Critically acclaimed author and researcher Anthony F. Sanchez breaks down the secret underground base and gives readers the innermost glimpse of the secretive military-industrial complex and the forbidden alien agenda. Learn how Sanchez explains the origins of humanity with startling proof, detailing how off-world intervention has been the cause for humanity's rapid and exponential growth in technology. As time draws down, are you prepared for the truth? Order this incredible, eye-opening book today at www.ufohighway.com. That's www.ufohighway.com.
Here on the Conspiracy Hour, we're going to deal with lots of conspiracies, some of them happening right now, today, as we do this show, going into the fall of 2012. But let's talk about something that happened 11 years ago first, won't we? Let's talk about 9/11.
Everyone remembers seeing the airplane go into the Twin Towers at 8:45 that morning in September 2001, right? President Bush even talked about it on TV.
I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower. TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there, and didn't have much time to think.
But wait, there is a problem with what we think we remember we saw about 9/11. Did you know there was no video of the first plane hitting the first tower until the next day when a video from Fox TV suddenly appeared? Well, then, what about the president's statement? How did he see the first plane hit the tower? We know he didn't see the second plane hit the tower because he was in the classroom in Florida, right, reading the book to the elementary students, remember? This is just one of the mysteries of 9/11. We have with us Jim Fetzer. He's from scholarsfor911truth.org, a well-respected man from academia. Fitzer has been doing everything he can to tell a nation that what they saw or what they think they know about 9/11 may not be what really happened. Welcome to the show, Jim. Let's start it off by a question about you and 9/11. When did you first start to doubt the official story?
A magnificently engineered building should have been destroyed so rapidly. I didn't get really serious about it, though, for a couple of years after 9/11, although I'd done some kind of inquiries about it. But I got serious in December of 2005, actually, when I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth to bring together, you know, individuals who had special background training and experience to try to figure out what actually went on.
Tell us a little bit about Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
Well, it's a collection of individuals that fall into actually four different categories of membership. There are full members, associate members, a society associates, and student members. The full members tend to have academic backgrounds, advanced degrees, and so forth, and are particularly well prepared to conduct research on complex subjects like this. The associate members may not have academic affiliations or advanced degrees, but typically have backgrounds and abilities that are very appropriate for research, too. The society affiliates are persons without special research skills who want to support our objectives and goals. And then student members, of course, speaks for itself. We rapidly grew from December to 300 to 400 members by mid to late 2006. And it's very interesting, Jerry, that in the years before the founding of Scholars, if you were to track the amount of attention devoted to 9/11 in the mainstream media, it was virtually a flat line. And from the founding of Scholars in December 2005, there's simply a steady growth in active interest in 9/11. And today there's a multiplicity of organizations and groups devoted to this purpose. There's a Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's a Pilots for 9/11 Truth. There was a Student Scholars for 9/11 Truth, though the most active members have now graduated and that group has more or less disbanded. Most importantly, there's a PatriotsQuestion911.com, which you can find online, or if you go to 911scholars.org, which is the home page for the society, which I maintain, you'll find in the upper right-hand corner an icon for Patriots Question 9/11. And if you go there, you'll find in five or six different categories, some for government and intelligence and military officials, some for academicians and professors, others for family members and survivors, pilots, engineers, and all that. You're going to find, it may be as many as 1,400 now individuals who are relatively public and well-known who have come out about 9/11, and where you'll find photographs and biographical sketches and statements they made about 9/11. So anyone who thinks that there's, it's a 9/11 research is in any way a fringe activity should go there to be disabused of that notion, not to mention that research surveys have shown somewhere between 40% and 50% of the American people don't believe what the government has told them about 9/11.
So you are saying the CIA controls our media?
Yeah. Well, Carl Bernstein,
Woodward and Bernstein fame, Watergate,
published an article in Rolling Stone in 1977 entitled "CIA and the Media," where he had investigated and discovered from CIA officials themselves that they were boasting that their greatest successes in infiltrating and manipulating the media were with Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS News. William Colby, subsequently, before his death, of course, in a very odd kayaking incident on the Potomac, told others that the CIA owned every reporter or media figure of significance in relation to the news. And I'm willing to believe that between 1977 and 2007, say, that the CIA did make great progress. so many of these, you know, the mass media have been allowed to be consolidated. They're controlled by a small number of corporations. Many of them have vast ties to the government. They're very dependent on administrations for news. They've tended to eliminate their investigative reporters because they're expensive and it often takes them lots of time to develop stories. So that for the most part, the American press has lost its capacity to fulfill the function for which our founding fathers intended, which was, of course, to keep the government press...
to keep them honest, that's what you're saying.
To do our best to keep us keep the government honest and keep the American people informed. I'm afraid today we have, more disinformation than truth is being broadcast over our mainstream media. I think, Jerry, actually you can learn, get more accurate reports on the Middle East war, for example, from Al Jazeera or from Pravda than you can from the U.S. media. It's embarrassing and shameful, but it's true.
As we mentioned at the top of the show in the first segment, James H. Fitzer has been active and still is in the 9/11 truth movement. In fact, he recently had a Vancouver tribunal, and we'll get into that in a later show. We asked Fitzer many years ago on an interview how he felt about former President George Bush. Was Bush really involved, or were they playing him like an accordion?
Very embarrassing. I think Bush has been very much manipulated by Dick Cheney, but Bush also had to be in the know. He's made some devastating lapses, however. For example, when he said that, and he made this statement at least twice, that when he saw that first plane hit the tower, he thought, man, what a bad pilot.
Yeah, we played that at the top of the show.
And that it was only after he was told of the second attack, when he was actually sitting in an elementary schoolroom in Sarasota, Florida, that he realized the country was under attack. Well, there were no television cameras focused on the North Tower at the time, so assuming that what he's saying is true, and I think it has to be true because it makes no sense any other way, the Secret Service had a special camera focused on the North Tower, which Bush observed, but didn't know enough to keep it to himself, which, of course, obviously indicates foreknowledge.
Secret Service or someone with a camera on it. You know, I think you've been involved in suggesting there might have been some video manipulation as well by Fox or someone in the know in advance. Maybe even the BBC. I mean, they did have that famous film clip there, where the lady was reading a script about the building falling apart and it hadn't done it yet, or vice versa. I don't remember exactly how that worked. But they were ahead of the game by a few minutes, so they had prior knowledge.
There's much more in this direction. But even if you took the official account from the administration, Jerry, he's trying to rewrite history, because we all know there were multiple, alleged reports of the possibility that Al-Qaeda was going to try to hit the United States, and that the possibility of using planes as weapons was well known. There had been previous operations that had been broken up that involved such efforts, and Zakarias Moussaoui, who was supposed to have been the 20th hijacker, was actually indicted and convicted of having participated in a plot to hit the White House with a plane in an ill-fated attempt to free the blind sheikh who had organized the attack on the Twin Towers in 1993. Now, a very curious thing happened that I think is very revealing of the Bush administration modus operandi here in relation to 9/11, which is after Moussaoui was convicted in 2005, April 2005 of this offense, he wasn't tried until 2006, about exactly a year later. And now the federal prosecutors have played a shell game, and they're trying him for a death or life imprisonment based on the supposition that if only he'd come forward to report about the plot to hit New York City, that they might have saved lives. But, of course, that's ridiculous on multiple grounds. That wasn't the offense for which he was convicted. Number two, we have a Fifth Amendment that doesn't require, you're not required to incriminate yourself. In the third place, this is atrocious, because even during the testimony, an FBI agent came forward to say he'd been tracking Moussaoui, and he had reported to his superiors that he was worried he might be involved in some kind of plot, that he'd even tossed out the idea of hitting the the Twin Towers, though he said later he thought that was just a lucky guess. But he testified under oath in court, Jerry, that he had reported this to his superiors, this warning, not once or twice, not three or four times. I mean, a half a dozen times you might say, well, that's civil incompetence. You get into many more times, say two dozen or so, and you realize there's something more sinister going on, some kind of criminal intent. Actually, he reported to his superior 70 times, Jerry, which means this had to be an official policy of the government to keep these guys under wraps until the event occurred and they could roll them out as patsies.
Now, you're up in Minneapolis, right?
I'm now in Madison, actually. I retired from the Duluth campus where I taught for the last 19 years of my 35-year university career.
But back to 9/11. It's interesting they were able to pull this thing off as quickly as they did. I mean, Bush had only been in office, what, 9 months?
No, you're right. You're right. It's very interesting. Well, I believe that it had been percolating for some time in the minds of these neoconservatives, so-called, and their project for a new American century, who had the grand scheme of creating an American empire worldwide. Especially.
Well, the neocon movement, they really have made no secret that they want to control the world.
That's exactly right. They even say so in one of their documents, that they wanted to project American power into the heart of the Middle East and then exert it outward from that geopolitically sensitive area. There's a string of over 700 bases worldwide. We're trying to encircle Russia with all kinds of military bases and entering into the Eastern European countries that were former republics, part of the Soviet Union, even though, you know, Reagan agreed to Khrushchev that we wouldn't do any such thing when Khrushchev went about dissolving the Soviet Union. So we're betraying many promises and trusts, but with the Bush administration, that's nothing new. That's something they did from day one by, for example, pulling out of the Kyoto Accords, which were devoted to try and constrain greenhouse gases and so forth to control global warming. But the neocons, so many of them were experienced from previous administrations. Both Cheney had been a former chief of staff, Rumsfeld, a former secretary of defense. They knew how to push the buttons and pull the levers, Jerry. So they knew when they came in, they knew how much power they'd have, and they went about putting it together quite rapidly. Now, my research suggests that the American military had a key role here, but that they were also aided and abetted by our ally in the Middle East, Israel, in the form of the Mossad having had a role here, too. I've outlined some of this in a piece. Actually, I gave a speech, one of the few political speeches I've ever given, on the grass in front of the Capitol building on the 15th of April of just last year. It was a Ron Paul freedom rally. It combined elements of recognizing Ron Paul, standing up for the Constitution, opposing unjust taxes. And I was invited by the Granny Warriors who sponsored it to speak on 9/11. Now, Ron Paul hadn't been outspoken about 9/11, so I wanted to make sure they knew what I was going to say before I spoke, but they assured me they were very confident and wanted me to speak. So I explained what I take to be the big picture and how much we've been deceived by the government in terms of the combined motives that really underlay and motivated 9/11, which were gaining access to oil in the Middle East and controlling it, benefiting Israel by destroying the most modern and sophisticated Arab state. I mean, Iraq, before we started to bomb it back to the Stone Ages, had the most sophisticated health care system, public education, arts, and, you know.
Now, unfortunately, I think if you ask the population of the United States, if you could talk to everyone here, most would probably say that what you just said is news to them.
Jerry, it's a shame. You know, it's as though the average American has utterly no capacity to see the world the way anyone else would see it. There's a kind of myopia that affects this nation that we have to overcome as a people, or we're forever going to remain vulnerable to the manipulation of clever politicians.
Well, frankly, I put all this naivety right on the back of the U.S. media. Somehow we've expanded the TV media universe to 300 channels and at the same time dumbed down everything. I'm not quite sure how that worked. You got more of nothing.
Jerry, I think you're absolutely right. The great journalists of the past, like Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite or even Chet Huntley and Brinkley. I mean, this is so far in the distant past that what we have today are talking heads who are considered to be a great success if they can read, a teleprompter. And that's the bottom line for them.
Well, the bottom line really is, I'm not sure if I agree with Jane Spencer completely on the incompetence of the media, but it's pretty hard to defend them, that's for sure. That wraps up this segment of the Conspiracy Hour.
You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat.